supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a festive question of the week for you. This week, cats and kittens, a lot of you have amaryllis in bloom, or you're going to get one of those little kits for the holidays, and a lot of people just toss them because there's so much trouble to get to rebloom. Well, my sister-in-law down in Virginia Beach has gotten great rebloom from an amaryllis I gave her a decade ago, and we will reveal her secret after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Phyllis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Phyllis. Where are you?
I'm in, actually, Summers Point, New Jersey.
Okay, you're down the shore.
Yep.
Very good. Are you a year? Are you a year-round resident?
I am.
All right. What can we do for Phyllis down the shore?
Well, I have a coffee bean plant that I've had for about, I want to say, 7 years. When I bought it, it was about 10 inches tall, and now it's about 6 feet tall.
Excellent.
It just got its first three little coffee beans. But the problem I have is, I would say 25% of the leaf, half of that leaf is just brown, just totally brown. The other half is green and healthy. Hoping you can tell me how I can remedy that problem.
So you don't have brown leaves. You have a number of leaves that have dual identities that are doing two-face.
Yep.
That's unusual. I will tell you that Coffea, the scientific name for the coffee plant, is actually a remarkably easy house plant for most people. I can remember back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we did an article on, like, the most super cool house plants. You know, we did indoor citrus and we did birds of paradise. But I was surprised in editing the piece to find out that coffee was not only a lot easier to grow than people would think, but that as the plant matures, you do get actual coffee beans. And if you get really good at this and you have the perfect conditions, I think you can get up to a pound of beans a year when the plant is fully mature. And you say this is the first year you got beans.
Yes.
Okay, so it should be uphill from here. Now, tell me what kind of conditions it is in. Does it go outside in the summertime?
No, because when I did that, it did seem to be a little healthier, but it also got bugs.
Right.
So I keep it in a eastern window.
Right.
And gets plenty of daylight. And it probably isn't very humid because it's right next to the fireplace.
Ah, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
You know, we're always warning people to back off on the watering of their house plants over the winter because the plants go dormant, they don't use enough water. But there are always exceptions to every rule. And there are some plants where the medium really has to be kept pretty moist. And coffee is not only up there. Coffee, you're supposed to keep the soil evenly moist all the time. But you're also supposed to mist the leaves every morning. If you really think about fair trade coffees and shade grown coffees and coffees that are grown in areas where they're protecting the songbirds that live alongside these plants, we're talking about tropical areas that are humid a lot of the time. And especially in most homes, the indoor air can get very dry over the winter. So when you have house plants and you know you've killed them by overwatering them in the past, one of the great antidotes to winter air is misting. I can't think of many plants that wouldn't enjoy it. And with your coffee, it could bring it up to full strength. But I think you said it's right next to an actual fire?
The fireplace. Mm-hmm.
Is there another window? Because coffee, as I just said, is shade grown. So it doesn't need direct sunlight. It does well with indirect sunlight. You know, especially with the size plant you have, if you wanted to move it off to a corner where it wasn't being subjected to a lot of dryness, that's something you could hang a plant light over top of. The LED plant lights they're coming out with now are really super spectacular. And, you know, you get these leaves back up to their full potential, and you know they're very glossy and bright and waxy.
Yeah.
So I would say the things you need to know is it likes bright light, but indirect light. They can be actually injured by direct sunlight, which is not unusual. That's the case for a lot of plants, and it doesn't want to be near a heat source. It definitely wants to be kept constantly moist. Now, it doesn't mean water in the saucer underneath. You don't want water to collect there, but you also want that potting soil to stay moist. And I tell you, misting it every morning, even twice a day, would make this thing so happy.
Oh, I'm going to try that.
All right, Phyllis.
All right, great. Well, thank you so very much, and have a great holiday.
Well, thank you, Phyllis. I love talking about these coffee plants. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ed, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I'm located in Lower Merion Township in Villanova.
Okay, very good. You're not an alumnus, are you?
No, I went to a better university, Lehigh.
All right, out in the Lehigh Valley. Yes, Lehigh is a great school, renowned for their engineering program.
And business also.
Very good. So what can we do for Ed, who went to Lehigh but now lives in Villanova?
I need some advice on wintering over bulbs. I have dahlias, glads, and cannas. And I sort of know what to do, but I can't locate anywhere any bags with holes in them so the bulbs get air once I put them in peat moss. So I need advice from you on the process and where I might find the bulbs.
You mean the bags?
The bags.
You got the bulbs.
I got the bulbs. They're all out.
And they are just kind of sitting out now, waiting storage, kind of curing?
Correct. They're in the basement doing that.
Okay. And you have your peat moss.
I have my peat moss.
And you're going to moisten the peat moss just the tiniest bit.
Okay. I'll do that.
Have you stored them successfully in the past, Ed?
I've stored the glads and the cannas, but not the dahlias.
In other words, this is your first year with dahlias, or they've died before?
I had them before, but I didn't know that you had to have them moist and air, you know, bags for them. I just put them in regular paper bags and put them in peat moss and put them in the basement in a box.
And did it work?
No. Maybe out of 20 bulbs, maybe five came through.
And they looked withered?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It's both easy and tricky. It's a delicate balance. Whatever medium you store them in, I have used seed starting mix, you know, soil-free mix. I've used peat moss.
Correct.
Some people use pure vermiculite.
Correct.
Or pure perlite. And the idea is you want to gently mist that material, but you don't want to wet it because it's easy for the bulbs to rot in storage. And one issue or one rule of thumb is what's the humidity typically in the area where they're being stored? Or, you know, is this a house where if you get mad at another family member, you rub your fingers on the floor, you rub your feet on the floor and then you touch them and electrocute them? Or is this a house that has good indoor humidity over the winter?
Probably moderate. I store them in the basement.
Right. And the basement tends not to get as dry as the upstairs.
Correct.
Right. So I would lightly moisten your peat moss, and I would put them in regular paper bags. And then once they're in the paper bags, I would sit the paper bags in cardboard boxes. And then with the bags in the boxes, I would just use a regular pair of scissors to cut some slits into the bags. And then, depending on how much peat moss you have, because obviously this is something you're going to reuse no matter what, then some people would even say to pack around the bags
with
more peat moss, moisten that, and store the boxes not sealed, but you know that trick where you fold the tops down.
Correct.
So again, there's good airflow going there. Keep them off the ground so the bottoms of the boxes don't get damp. And depending on your experience, have you ever had a mouse in the house?
Rarely.
The smart money says that it wouldn't hurt to go out and get a couple of basic mouse traps and bait them with peanut butter and leave them next to the boxes.
Okay, I can easily do that.
Because that's sometimes, especially in a harsh winter, mice will come inside and they like to gnaw into cardboard boxes anyway.
Okay.
And then if they see there's something good inside, they'll do what comes naturally.
Okay, great.
All right, and again, with these, real, especially with the dahlias, make sure you don't take them out too early. They really don't have any sense of humor about temperatures in the 40s.
Okay. Oh, okay, because I just took them out last week after a couple of frosts.
That's okay. Lifting them, so to speak, after a couple of light frosts is good. It concentrates the sugars. Don't rush them back outdoors.
Okay, that's good advice.
All right, Ed.
And thank you very much, and your show is a very good show, and I appreciate the call.
Well, thank you so much, sir.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that tickets to the Philadelphia Flower Show make perfect holiday gifts, and that membership in PHS, the people who put on the flower show, includes free tickets to the Flower Show. But don't go looking for all the details at theflowershow.com just yet, because we'll be right back with tips on getting your amaryllis to rebloom and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Grand American Tours. In July of 2015, Mike McGrath will be hosting a Viking river cruise through the gardens of Provence. More at 800-423-0247 or grandamericantours.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, have you been frustrated in the past by trying to get an amaryllis to rebloom for you after that first great show it put on? Well, it just turns out that my sister-in-law stumbled upon the secret to getting rebloom every year and bigger and better blooms every time. We'll tell you what that is when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, it's a fascinating phone call show at 1-888-346-9499. Irene, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Irene. How are you?
Very well, and I'm in St. John in the Virgin Islands.
Oh, we have broadcast radio in the Virgin Islands, don't we?
You do, out of St. Thomas.
Oh, man, I keep saying this time of year, I got to come down and inspect those stations for safety.
Oh, you should. It's so beautiful. 80 degrees right now.
Oh, hurt me. Oh. We got ice dams and slush and freezing rain and sleet.
There's a direct flight, I think, from Philadelphia.
I'm on it. I'm heading to the airport now. So can we help you with something, or did you just call or rub it in?
Yes, you can help me. I have these big, beautiful terracotta pots that I've planted some small trees in. I have a lang-a-lang and a bay rum tree planted in these. And I did them about 2 years ago, and I used the soilless mixture like you recommended and about a third homemade compost in the pots. And so now the soilless is compacted down, and we've got this huge space at the top, you know, between the soil and the top of the pot.
Right.
I'm wondering if, I know I need to add some soil, but I don't know what you think I should do, how I should do it.
How big are these trees at this point?
Well, let's see, the langalang is about 7 feet tall, but it's very thin, you know, the trunk is small. It's
right.
A flowering tree, and the bay rum tree is probably 9 feet tall. They're small, they've been there 2 years or more.
And they're in terracotta pots.
Yes, those big pots from Tuscany.
So are they sitting on bare ground?
Actually, I have them on cinder blocks, which are in the ground slightly, and then there's a base of pea gravel around those. You can't see them.
I'm just wondering if the roots are trying to come out the bottom.
Well, that was a problem I used to have because this is under a coconut palm, and the roots would come up from the palm into the palm.
So
that's why I put them on the cinder block, and I put some of that fabric, you know, the weed barrier fabric, under the pot.
Right, to keep the rogue plants from coming inside.
Yeah, they still will do it. You know, it deteriorates, but...
You're in a very lush area. You know, stuff just grows like mad where you are.
Oh, it rains and the sun shines.
Yeah. And how are the trees looking?
Very well.
Yeah, see, that makes me not want to do too much. The Spalding guide for this would be to get a bunch of guys, turn the pots on their side with some fabric, something protective underneath, so the pots didn't get broken or chipped.
Okay.
And then, you know, get a piece of rebar or something, because I presume there's one big hole in the bottom of these pots for drainage.
Yes.
Get a piece of rebar or something like that and try to, and then get some guys at the other end and see if you can move the tree up in the pot. And
okay.
Then, here's the tricky part, using some sort of a funnel or something, add the soil in the bottom.
Okay.
Because we don't want to cover the trunk
right. With
a lot of soil. But if you were up for a great gardening cowboy exotic locale adventure, that's exactly what I would try to do.
Okay.
I would turn these things on their side, maybe get a machete or something, run it around the inside of the pot.
Okay.
So that maybe you can, because you know what I mean, then it's possible the whole schmageggy will be able to pull forward the tree with all the soil wrapped around its roots.
Right.
And then pour a mixture of compost and soil into the bottom and keep doing that until the tree is now, the soil line is seated a little bit more towards the top. That would be the best.
Okay, I can try that. We'll just try to get a couple of guys and pull that thing, gently move that thing out a little bit.
Yeah, that to me would be the best thing to do. If you don't want to do that, and nobody in their right mind would blame you for not wanting to do that, I would just add an inch of compost, no more potting soil or anything, an inch of compost on the surface where you are, because your plants are growing constantly. You have no seasonality whatsoever.
Right.
I would do that, an inch of compost 3 times a year on top, slowly. You don't want to do anything quickly. And I think the best answer would be to try to refill the bottom. But definitely, if you want to keep the plants healthy, because they do burn through nutrients very quickly in your kind of environment,
mm-hmm.
adding an inch of compost 3 times a year would add to the soil level and feed the plants at the same time.
Okay.
I can't believe you have a bay rum tree.
It is so beautiful. And you know, you can use the leaves for, for insect deterrent. You can put them around on the ground. And I mean, around if like in our laundry room, we put them down for roaches and things like that.
Right, because your roaches are 10 feet long, right?
They are. They fly.
Yeah. We are all so jealous.
Well, come see us. We'd love to. We have a national park here. We'd love to see you.
I'd love to see it. I'm gonna make my way down there. All right. Well, thank you, Irene.
Thank you.
Take care.
Love your program. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. George, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, George. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
And where is George doing very well?
Folsom, New Jersey.
Oh, in Folsom Prison. You're with that.
That's what my wife said when I first brought her down here, but now she likes it.
Good, good. Where is Folsom?
I call it the suburbs of Hamilton.
Okay. Okay, so you're in South Jersey.
South Jersey, next to Williamstown.
Okay, very good. What can we do for George in Folsom? Hopefully getting out soon. No.
We built a new house a few years ago, and our area of Folsom is very, very sandy. We call it sugar sand.
Right.
You can't do anything with it. So I brought in 200 tons of topsoil, and I did about a 3-acre area. We have 20 acres altogether, and I was finally, after a couple of years, getting a pretty decent, nice lawn. Well, my wife got a puppy in the spring, and the puppy's a large husky, and she digs everywhere. I mean, unbelievable. So this whole summer, I figured I'll put the lawn on hold and try again next year. Maybe she'll grow out of it.
Right. First of all, the time to repair a lawn in the Northeast, I presume you have a fescue bluegrass lawn?
A little bit of everything I tried.
Yes, but it's all cool season grasses.
Yes.
Yes. The time to do those repairs is at the end of August, George.
Oh.
So, yeah, if you've been sowing the seed in the spring,
right,
that would be a reason you would have a weak lawn. Grass seed needs a really warm soil to germinate. And then, by the time the soil's warm enough for germination, generally the temperatures are getting too hot for a young, cool season grass to thrive. In mid-August, the soil temperature is perfect. You get instant germination, and then every day it's getting a little bit cooler so that by the time summer's heat arrives, and summer is as big a threat to your lawn as your dog, that lawn is a year old and it has a good root system. So there's two things we want to do here. One is I want you to be prepared in August to spread either more topsoil or more compost and then overseed the area.
I was going to bring another truckload of topsoil, and each truck has 25 tons.
The time to get those trucks rolling in is in July. Get it all spread and leveled out, and then sow the seed on August 15th. The lawn will be bulletproof, although you realize you do have to keep the dog off the lawn for a little while as the seed is germinating and it's establishing.
I was hoping you could give me some hints how to keep the dog off the lawn.
And this is happening in the summertime, right?
And she does it all the time now. But some of the holes are literally 25 feet long, and some holes are 2 feet deep. And I never seen her dig a hole yet.
Do you think that you have underground critters?
Yes, I think that's what she's chasing.
Right. And see, because you have sandy soil underneath all this, it's very easy for moles and groundhogs and voles to travel through your soil. And she's going to hear that and chase them. One thing you want to do, establish a ritual, train the dog. You want to start taking the dog out to an area that you don't care about, an out-of-the-way place where she'll be allowed to dig, and then take the dog out there, and then you dig with her. You show her. And then after she digs there, give her a treat, reinforce that, and do that continually for about a month so that she associates this one area with good dog, and this is where they can dig. And the nice thing about dogs as opposed to cats is dogs do want to please us. So positive reinforcement and praise will really help a dog do what you want. In addition to this, I also think you should treat the areas that she's digging up with a castor oil product. You will find both liquids and solid castor oil concentrations sold for mole and vole control. As soon as the weather warms up in the spring, you should spread this over the areas of the lawn that she's damaging. As it rains and this castor oil product gets down into the soil, it makes the soil smell bad and it's unattractive to burrowing creatures. It won't harm your dog, but your dog may not like the smell either. So that may be another incentive for the dog not to go digging if the soil doesn't smell good. And if you've reinforced, there's this place you both go play and you dig and you have a good time.
Sounds great. Thanks for the information.
All right. Good luck, George.
Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Pamela, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Pamela. How are you?
I'm great.
And where is Pamela great?
In Upper Darby.
What can we do for Pamela in Upper Darby?
I had always thought that you're supposed to clean up your garden in the fall, get rid of all the dead plants so they won't provide homes for insects during the winter. But then I read in the Philadelphia Inquirer a few weeks ago that you shouldn't clean up your garden in the fall because it provides home for insects. And apparently they thought that most insects were good instead of bad. And that has not generally been my experience. So I don't know what to believe. Should I get rid of all my sunflower stalks and dead tomato plants and things like that, or should I leave them?
Okay, so those are two good examples to get started with. You should definitely get rid of your tomato plants because tomatoes tend to be prone to every disease under the sun. And one of the big reasons to remove, quote, spent plants from the garden is to prevent the retransmission of disease the following year. And you want to mark where they grew, however, so that you know not to put tomatoes in the same spot again next year. Were you to do anything that would split the difference, you would prune the plant down, get rid of all the leaf matter, and maybe leave that stalk so you know not to put tomatoes in exactly that same spot again next year. That would be a smart thing to do. Again, one of the reasons we're told to clean up the garden, it's not so much to prevent insect pests from overwintering, but it is to prevent disease from overwintering. For instance, in my garden, I have to religiously clean up underneath my peach trees, make sure there's no dropped peaches under there, make sure there's no old leaves. Anything like that is an absolute drop-dead vector for disease the following year. Same thing under roses. You want to remove all the dead stuff. Certainly get it out of there by early spring because that can harbor disease. Insects, as you found out, it can go either way. You're going to have good insects overwintering out there, but you're also going to have bad insects. This is how stink bugs overwinter, the ones that can't get into your house. They're going to be underneath mulches and plant debris. But as you've discovered, you can also have praying mantis out there. You can have spiders out there, which are great to have in the garden. And here's my dyslexia coming in. I forget if the word is allopathic or allopathic. One's a doctor and one kills plants. But like the black walnut, like the roots especially of the black walnut, but also the leaves, sunflower husks, hulls, contain a naturally occurring chemical that prevents the growth of other plants. So if you don't clean up underneath your sunflowers, that can be a dead zone the next year. And just this year, I have a native weed in my garden called fleabane that has these beautiful little daisy-like flowers.
Yeah, I tolerate some of that.
Well, I got the most amazing caterpillars on some of my plants at the end of the season that are obviously the larval form of the swallowtail. And they were feeding on these plants, so I was very careful to leave those standing, even though they look like Hades right now. But, I mean, the smart thing is get rid of anything that was diseased. And if you really want to be smart, you learn the weeds that can harbor disease. Disease can hide in a related weed and then infect your plants the next year. In terms of insects, I'd say off the top of my head, it's 50-50. You've got just as good a chance of keeping good ones alive as bad ones. And if you like good garden insects and you want to change your numbers, in the spring, an old ancient Chinese tactic is to make little teepees out of hay or straw, make these little round conical bales throughout your garden. And when spiders are spawning in the spring, especially garden spiders, the orb weavers, they will come to these little straw castles and live inside and eat your garden pests for you. All right?
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck, Pam. Just make sure no matter what, all diseased plants are out of the garden.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. You take care.
Go on.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody with a cut Christmas tree in the house to make sure that there's always fresh water in that tree stand. Because if that reservoir goes bone dry, your tree may not be able to take up any more water afterwards. But don't go crawling under your tree just yet, because we'll be right back with tips on getting your amaryllis to rebloom and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY. In Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Grand American Tours. In July of 2015, Mike McGrath will be hosting a Viking river cruise through the gardens of Provence. More at 800-423-0247 or grandamericantours.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will reveal what my sister-in-law has learned over the past decade that has made her wonderful amaryllis not only rebloom year after year, but look better year after year. No more tossing those bulbs away or getting frustrated by just leaves. You won't want to miss this vital reblooming information, and you won't. It's coming up after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Barry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's Barry from Williamstown, New Jersey.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, I met you a couple years ago at the WHYY Summer Soiree.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a certified organic guide that was also a nuclear operator.
But, now, wait a minute. We met in an HYY event, and and you're an organic. You're an organic.
I'm a certified organic farmer. Yeah, and I was, but at the time, I used to also be a nuclear control room operator. I'm a full-time farmer now.
So you did grow like 10-pound tomatoes.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's big ones. Yeah, although we don't really sell that many of them. Big ones. No one wants to pay that kind of money for when you sell them by the pound.
All right. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, what I'm calling about is our farm was it was bought by my father-in-law, and he's 94 years old now.
Right.
He bought the property in 1955. And there was I must be a Bartlett tree. I don't know the exact cultivar, you know, which Bartlett it is, but it must be one of the old varieties, because it was a full-size tree back then in his backyard. And for years, it hadn't made pears. And my mom from Upper Michigan taught me a trick of early spring, wrapping up a newspaper real tight. And she said, don't use a stick because it damaged the tree too much. But she would stimulate it by whacking the bark, you know, a little bit with a rolled up newspaper. Well, sure enough, this tree is making beautiful pears. And the problem is the pears at the bottom of the tree taste great, and the pears at the middle of the tree taste great, where I, you know, my wife lifts me up with the loader tractor and I can pick them. But the pears at the top of the tree, I can't taste because they're just too tall. And the thing must be 30 feet high.
Right.
So my question is, I don't want to, you know, obviously kill this tree, but I'd like to maybe a couple of the upper branches, be able to cut them off to stimulate the bottom ones to grow better. But I'd hate to also cut too much off and, you know, hurt this tree that's obviously must be 70, 80 years old.
Okay. I think I know where you're going. One of the things, obviously, with fruit trees like this, it's always good to train them when they're young. And what you would be doing is essentially the same as I do with my peach trees, is always cutting off the highest branches, what my friend Lee Wright calls developing a new central leader. Really, it's for two reasons. One is to keep the tree open and airy, but the other is to keep the tree from becoming so big that you can't reach the fruit up top, because that's where disease and pest problems will start, when you can't get up and take care of the fruit. One of the things you want to avoid with a pear tree is pruning it in the spring when it's already started to grow. That's when I prune my peaches. But pears are very aggressive regrowers. When you prune them.
Yes, I did see that. We had a branch that got broke in a windstorm, and it's amazing how many new leaders came out of it right away.
Right. And you want to avoid stimulating too much new growth, because that new growth is vulnerable to fire blight disease, which is the biggest problem that pears experience. So if you're willing to do it sometime over this winter, in the dead of winter, would be a good time. And what I would do is I would go up in your bucket and reach as high as I could safely, and then making sure you can't cut branches that are too long, because that would be a danger to you and could rip the bark off the tree. You have to remove them in sections. But I would not hesitate to reduce the height of this tree, again, doing it safely, by five feet the first year. The ideal would be to reduce the height over a period of 3 to 4 years, get rid of any gnarly branches up there, get rid of any branches that are sticking straight up. And your goal would be, over a five-year period, to reduce this thing to a manageable height. And one of the interesting things about pears is, unlike apples and peaches, you don't really have to thin the fruits too much. The only reason you should thin the fruits is if you have so much fruit that it's bending the branch down. And that happens quite a bit. And that weight can actually,
this year.
Yeah, that can break a branch. So you want to watch where the fruits are forming. And when they're small, if you see there's just too many on a branch for the branch to be able to support the weight, pull off every other fruit while it's still small.
Okay.
But you're perfectly right to start reducing it in height. and the time to do this is in the dead of winter, even though it's a complex equation, that's a way to avoid the lush new growth that leads to fire blight.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. My pleasure, Bauer. Enjoy your pears.
Yes, thank you.
Take care, man.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm so excited to talk to you.
I'm excited to talk to you, Karen.
I'm calling from Seneca Falls, and I have a passion for doing living potted Christmas trees. And I have not had such great success at it. I've got a couple that are pretty tall, but I just recently found you and started listening to you, and I think we've been doing a lot of things wrong. So I want to have success, and I was hoping that you could let me know what you would do.
Absolutely. I've done this myself. Now, Seneca Falls, is that in New York?
Yes, it is.
Okay. We have a tree, I presume.
Yes, I do. It's a blue spruce.
I love blue spruces. And how tall is the tree? Is it a full-size tree? Is it like 5-6 feet?
Well, yes, it's almost 5.
Okay. And is it in the house now?
No. What I understand, it's best to leave it out and only bring them in for 2 weeks.
Not even that long, but it seems like you're in good shape here. Now, do you have the hole dug?
No. I thought maybe we should, we have a greenhouse, and so maybe we should put it in the greenhouse.
No.
And wait and plant it in the fall.
No.
Because now it's too late to do the hole.
That's the issue. The next time the ground is unfrozen, you really should try to dig a hole, because otherwise it's going to be dicey. The other thing that I could suggest, you know, if you can't get a hole in the ground, find some place where you can cover the pot completely with a big mound of soil and then plant it in the spring.
What about keeping it in a greenhouse?
No, then it's going to wake up and it's going to get all confused by the seasons.
Okay.
You
all
know,
right.
You really need to be a professional to do that. Now, the short take is when you have a live Christmas tree, the best answer is to decorate it outside and keep it outside. Otherwise, if you want to bring it into the house, what you want to do is you want to gradually harden it off. Instead of just bringing it in from a 20-degree day to a 60-degree house, you want to move it to a secondary area, like an unheated garage, where it'll warm up a little bit. And then literally, the fewest days you can have it inside, the better. And it should be in the coldest room of the house. Yes. You really want it to be in tune with the outdoor seasons as much as possible. Turn the heat down. Make sure it's, even if your traditional spot has to be moved, don't put it near a radiator or a fireplace or anything like that.
Yeah, we've been doing the wrong thing. But we have been putting ice in it.
No. That's not going to compensate.
Okay.
The short take is gradually bring it in. Keep it in for the shortest time possible. And no incandescent lights, no lights that give off heat, just like LEDs. Keep it away from all sources of heat. Keep it cool. You can't do that with ice. The room has to be cool. And then when you're ready to take it outside, do the same thing. Don't take it from your house to the outdoors. Take it to like an unheated garage. Let it sit there for 4 or 5 days. Get acclimated. The more you can gradually get it used to coming inside and then get it used to going back outside with the shortest actual inside time, the better. And if you can't dig a hole to get it into the ground, find like a depression somewhere that gets good sun, that's going to be near where it is, and then find some loose unfrozen soil or compost and completely cover the pot with it, healing it in as they would do at a garden center or nursery.
Okay.
And then as soon as you can, plant the tree in the ground, plant it in a wide hole, not a deep one, and make sure the root flare is visible after you're done planting. And
yes. Oh, you have been so helpful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Eighth time is the charm.
Okay.
All right. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Mike. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. an easier way to get amaryllis to rebloom. Now, a special program note, the part of producer Alexis Landis will be played this week by production assistant Peter Christian. Peter, read us this week's seasonal question.
Absolutely, Mike. Rebecca in Silver Spring, Maryland writes, "Last Christmas, a friend gave us an amaryllis that bloomed beautifully. I kept it alive and then moved it outside, where it grew lots of new leaves all summer and fall. But the leaves never turned yellow, and I finally brought it back inside just before our first freeze. Should I cut off the leaves, or are they still nourishing the bulb? How do I care for it so that it will bloom again?"
Well, I have to confess that when an old amaryllis of mine reblooms, it's a total accident. But my sister-in-law, Maureen, my brother's wife, down in Virginia Beach, quote, shared a photo of her astounding reblooming success on Facebook earlier this year, so I decided to interview her about her technique.
Why do you say she, quote, shared a photo?
Oh, because she was obviously bragging. And to really rub my nose in it, she pointed out that the bulbs in question had been a gift from me some 10 years ago.
I think that's very nice.
And where I grew up, it's called putting the boot in. But I would brag, too. The plant has matured sensationally under her care.
Huh. What do you think her secret is?
Well, first, she has a good hand with houseplants in general. Her orchids also really rebloom perfectly for her. And she doesn't try to force her amaryllis to rebloom at Christmas. She lets it follow a more normal pattern that allows the bulb to take advantage of a full summer sun and really recharge. She also suspects that these bulbs like being root-bound. She says she's only repotted them once in the last 10 years, and that was because the growing bulbs had split the pot open.
Bulbs? Plural?
Yeah, apparently I gave her a set of three bulbs nestled together in a big round pot, which is a real relief. I would have been insanely jealous if she had gotten a display like that from a single 10-year-old bulb. She told me she was tempted to try and separate them out once, but the roots were so tangled together she was afraid she'd damage them if she tried. So, anyway, the first year, she explained, she watered them, put them in decent light, and they bloomed nicely. I've never heard of new first-time bulbs not putting on a good show. Then she clipped off the tops of the stalks after the flowers had faded.
Is that important?
Yeah. Seed heads typically form at the top of the stalk after the flowers are gone. And if you don't clip those seed heads off, they'll drain energy from the bulb. Now, at this point, new leaves will emerge from the bulb, if they haven't already. Give them the best light you can. I suspect the fact that this normally happens in January with holiday amaryllis is one big limiting factor for rebloom.
Hmm, why is that?
Well, these tropical bulbs are like spring bulbs in one important regard. After the flowers fade, the green leaves collect solar energy to fuel the growth of the next round of flowers. Sunshine is abundant when spring bulbs are recharging, but the months after Christmas, not so much.
And you said they're tropical, so the plants can't go outside until there's no risk of frost. How did your sister-in-law deal with that?
Well, she wound up kind of accidentally back-ending their sunlight. The first year, she put the bulbs out after the weather warmed up, and she fed them. You should always give your amaryllis a gentle feeding as soon as they go back outside. But then she forgot about them until it started getting chilly. When she finally remembered, she brought them back inside and let them rest in a cool, dark place with no water for a couple of months.
Our listener said that her leaves were still green in November.
Well, that often happens. I just talked to Maureen again, and she said her leaves are still green from the summer. It doesn't matter. You have to bring them back inside before it gets too cold. Photosynthesis time is pretty much over by then anyway. So stop watering, let the leaves turn brown naturally, and then begin the 6-week to 3-month rest period.
And then what?
Well, then you be patient, because now is when you can finally set up your perfect timing schedule. Maureen says she typically lets hers continue to rest over the holidays and then brings them back into bright light and starts watering again in time to get blooms for Valentine's Day.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all. And with this relaxed timing, the bulbs don't have to go through nearly as long a period of poor light indoors. Take them outside when all risk of frost is gone. Gently feed them. Let those new leaves soak up rays for the entire summer. And then give the bulbs a nice long dormant period. You gain several huge advantages when you don't try to rush them into reblooming at Christmas. In fact, I think it's safe to say that the closer to May you wait to wake them up, the better the future reblooms are going to be. Yikes, my producer is threatening to assassinate my amaryllis if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore with your location at garden@whyy.org and visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's web page wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work. And please like us, at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor, Al Banks. He would never hurt a holiday flower. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, is going to get some coal in her stocking this year for saying that. Wait a minute. She doesn't do Christmas. She does Hanukkah. Do they even have stockings at Hanukkah? Oh, well. Coal in your dreidel. Our production assistant, Peter Christian. Ah, he's too nice to get coal. Petey gets an orange and a red rubber India ball. A recent college graduate, our hired hand Matt Hudecki, would like a big load of coal for the winter, and a stove, and a red rubber India ball. I'm your horticultural humbug, Mike McGrath, saying, why am I stuck with these losers? Are there no prisons, no workhouses? Where's my present? All they give me here is used coffee grounds and the time of day. Come to think of it, they haven't given me the time of day for a while. I want a red rubber India ball. Hey, Petey, I changed my mind. Give it back. Come on, give it back. Ah, darn, he's pretty feisty for a singer. All right, I'll settle for a half ball and a broomstick. And it's a home run if it hits the 68 Chevy parked over there, okay? And I'll see you next week. It's time once again to say ho, ho, ho. That's H-O-E, of course. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll present our annual holiday special, Only Charlie Brown's is Better.